All right, this was a very popular thing in very many, I don't know the exact number, but most homes had this from the 20s to the 70s and early 80s. Then it fell out of favor, and like, I think most homes didn't have this for a large chunk of the 2000s. But now, oh boy, it is back again. It's not record player, that was the first guest. Al, what do you think?
Fireplaces.
No, not fireplaces. Good guess, though. Kathy, where are you going?
Sewing machines.
It's not sewing machines, although that's a really good one, too. Thanks for playing, Kathy. Let's
Thank
go
you.
To Jeannie. Hi, Jeannie.
Oh, I'm changing it. That's a very
Oh, you
last
got it. You got to do what you told Iridian.
Oh, okay. I'm going to go with intercom system.
That's a good guess. That was my mom's second guess. You're both wrong. I'm so sorry. So, Mom, you have to keep on texting me again. Let's go to Gina. Hi, Gina. What do you think?
Hi. I think it's bidet.
I think that was Iridian's guess to me as well. That is not the answer. I'm sorry, but a good guess. It is not a bidet. Okay. We'll get to Chris soon, I hope, and Paul and Jim. Hang on the line. But now we go to Tom. Tom Appel, who is not allowed to guess the answer to the question of the day, but always welcome to join our program. Tom, hello. How are you?
I am well. Thank you.
I read about a recall, mainly because Iridian put it on this sheet of paper I have in front of me. Tesla, Ford, Toyota, Maserati, among over 850,000 vehicles recalled. Sometimes the recall number is like really big and it scares me for a moment, even though I don't own any of those cars. But sometimes it's like for a little thing. What are we dealing with here?
There's an interesting recall. The Tesla recall is interesting because it sounds big. It's something like 370,000 vehicles. But Tesla was a pioneer in over-the-air updates, which means that by cellular connection, Tesla can connect with your car and make a software update.
Whoa.
And this...
I said, whoa. Sorry, Tom, to interrupt.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And the interesting thing here is that Tesla is not going to require any of these vehicles to come back to a service center to be repaired, which in this case is huge. It's an issue with the power steering. And it's a software issue that basically prevents the vehicle from starting or from the power steering kicking in immediately after you lift your foot off the brake at a stop. So that's a big problem, and it would affect drivability. But Tesla's going to be able to execute this update entirely over the air. So you as a Tesla owner are not inconvenienced, and they're not paying service technicians to fix 375,000 cars.
Wow.
Instead, they're paying a few software engineers to get this thing fixed. So that's really impressive, but it's a huge recall.
That is slick, though. I like that. You know, a lot of the updates are software updates. Are other cars and manufacturers, they just didn't have the foresight to connect the cars to some network that they're able to do this? Or do you anticipate maybe this is something that other companies will be able to do in the future?
We're going to see it on every car eventually. And part of what's going on, too, is that when Tesla developed cars, especially the Model 3 and the Model Y, which are their most popular vehicles in the United States, those vehicles were designed brand new from the ground up fairly recently. So they were able to apply all this brand new technology. If you're dealing with a legacy car maker, General Motors, Ford, something like that, those vehicles are usually updates of previous vehicles. And to do something like this is fairly complicated and fairly expensive to modify existing technology. So what you're waiting for is complete updates of vehicles before this will be implemented on other vehicles.
Did you just feel the obligation to say something nice about Tesla after you bashed the Cybertruck the last time you came on?
I didn't, but it's kind of making me nervous, honestly.
Hey, no, Tom, you're fine. They're not going to update the software in your brain, Tom, from afar, I promise you, okay?
Okay, good.
Let's talk about an interesting partnership using Chinese batteries and lithium batteries. I know this is a market we are trying to get better into, but as far as I know, we're way behind the game. And Volkswagen, with a big nod to China and what they do there.
Yeah, so Volkswagen really wanted to be one of the pioneering companies in EVs. And they have built a lot of them, but they've run into some trouble. They've had trouble developing the EV architecture itself, and their current... Their brand new relationship with Rivian is designed in part for them to get access to Rivian's very good, apparently, EV architecture. But in China, Volkswagen has been working with other companies, and we're going to see now, I think, as the tariff battle heats up, that Volkswagen and other companies that do business in China are going to have to do more business in China. So they're not going to be able to import batteries if they were doing that after all. But they're partnering up with CATL, which is the world's largest battery manufacturer. They're in China, and Volkswagen is working with them to develop batteries specifically for the Chinese market for their products. And this is a couple of things going on here. They want to kind of lower the cost of the vehicles they're selling in China, and they want to do more business in China for the vehicles they're selling there.
Do we make a lot of batteries here in the U.S.?
Not yet, but we will. General Motors is making most of their vehicles here. Ford has a plan, though it's been delayed because of tariff situations, to build batteries here. And Stellantis recently put together a deal with a couple of manufacturers to develop a new technology battery for the U.S. So we will be building batteries here, and we are building some already.
Wasn't that part of the Biden plan, was to build, or am I thinking more about chips than batteries, to onshore as much as that is possible? Though I know the Trump administration has pushed back on some of these things.
Yes, the Trump administration has put back and had a slow development of these things. And General Motors had a plan, for example, to build four big factories in the U.S. to build batteries. The fourth one they have capitulated on, and they're going to let their partner on that factory go it alone. So we're seeing there was infrastructure plan. It's a lot of it's still in place, but a lot of it's being scaled back.
Tom dropping a five-syllable word on us, capitulated. Good job, Tom. I love that. Let's talk. You mentioned Stellantis there. They're on a search for a new CEO and could lead them in a new direction, perhaps.
Yeah, Stellantis ran into some real weird problems, and they probably needed more growth in car sales to kind of mask this. But a lot of things happened at the same time for Stellantis, and Ram sales are down. That's their big pickup, and that's their profit center. Jeep sales are down, largely because they killed a bunch of slow-selling models, but they did do some volume. And then at Chrysler, they're down to one model because they got rid of their big rear-wheel drive sedans. And the same thing happened at Dodge that was selling these muscle cars that were discontinued. So all these things have worked together to really, really hit Chrysler at the bottom line. And Stellantis, of course, usually makes most of its money off of North America. So this is looking dark. Stellantis does have plans in place to beef up those sales, but they're going to be a long time coming. There's like a mid-sized pickup, as we know, coming to Belvedere. So that'll be nice. That'll be some Illinois jobs. But that's still a couple years away.
So they need some changes, perhaps, and maybe a new CEO could lead them there.
Yeah, they need change. They need time.
Yeah. All right. I've got to think of a name for this segment. Does Steve and Johnny name your segment, Tom Appel? I always forget.
No, they do not. We should brand that.
Oh,
yeah.
But the pavement report? We can do better than that, I'm pretty sure. Tom, we'll come up with something and for our show, and then you can use that on Steve and Johnny if you want. I always appreciate them having you on. They're the first ones that had you, Tom, and we thank you for sharing your information with all the other shows, too. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure, sir.
Where can people get more about what you do?
Oh, check us out at consumerguide.com.
That's great. Tom, we'll talk soon, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks.
If anyone has any ideas, pavement report. I don't hate it. I don't love it. 312-981-7200. That's the phone line you call for guesses to the question of the day. We'll maybe get a couple more in before the news on WGN. All right, Tim Parody. Now Tim doesn't have to guess to the question of the day. You've been relieved of that, my friend. Welcome back to WGN. Hello, Tim. Are you there?
Hey, thanks for having me.
There might be a little delay here. Business Insider, you do a lot of great work there, and we're going to talk a little bit about what happens if you get laid off. And in your article, I'm kind of glad you started with like the deep breath psychological aspect of getting laid off, because it is a hit to our confidence, is it not?
Absolutely. All the workplace experts I talk to say this is a really major blow to how people feel, to people's self-esteem, all these things. We internalize a lot of stress on this, so it's definitely a hit. People need to recognize that.
So what do you do? How do you turn that hit into something productive?
Well, there are things you can do. I mean, there's the obvious stuff like the housekeeping type things, like, you know, ask your employer about, your former employer about, you know, the severance and some of those kinds of things, healthcare. Even sometimes you can ask for a letter confirming, you know, that you were laid off, as an example. But then there are other things you can do that you can sort of take a deep breath and think, all right, maybe I need to figure out what my plan should be. Can I build some skills, figuring out what you want to do around networking? And then there are even other things you can do once you, have taken a little bit of time and have grieved a little bit.
Okay, so you grieve a little bit, you take that time, and then what? Start cold calling? I mean, I think people often don't know where to begin, especially if maybe they've been laid off from a job they've had for a decade or so. It's changed a bunch out there.
Absolutely. And the key, really, from the folks I talk to is that networking is essential, because it's so easy to apply for jobs now. You know, you could spend all day just looking on job boards and apply and unfortunately often not hear back. And so that's not always a very fruitful thing to do. But talking to folks that you've worked with before, former bosses, former coworkers, even people you don't know, and just say, hey, I'd love to have, you know, 10 minutes for a quick Zoom, or maybe we could meet for a really quick coffee to hear about, you know, your company and what it's been like there. So that kind of stuff is often a more fruitful way for people to get insights into what, you know, who might be hiring and what the types of roles might be.
Is there something psychological about that too? Almost feeling like, hey, I'm doing something?
Absolutely. And again, I think that if you just sit there and you're, you know, you of course you want to beef up your resume and do all those things, but if you just sit there and kind of keep throwing that out into the world through various job sites, I think it's going to be pretty demoralizing pretty quickly. So if you can do something to, you know, again, to sort of feel like you're making contact with people and doing something and keeping up your network and, you know, making it even bigger, I think that can be really helpful for people.
For sure. I am someone who is a busybody. I can't imagine, and God forbid, although I have been laid off once before from a TV show, but God forbid that happens again, finding me with a lot of time is never a good thing. How do you fill the day? I guess you have to kind of step yourself up and make sure you do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, again, the folks I talk to say, you know, having some structure to your day can be really helpful so that you're not just sitting there staring at a screen and hitting refresh on your email waiting to hear back. So, you know, setting a schedule and making time for stuff like exercise and seeing friends, things like that. And you can even do things like, you know, volunteering. I've talked to a couple of folks who said that that's really helpful for numerous reasons, one being you kind of put things in perspective with what you're going through. Often there's somebody worse off. But then the other part of it is that it's even something you can talk about in a subsequent job interview. If somebody says, hey, what have you been up to? In addition to the fact that, oh, I've been taking classes or I've been, you know, getting this certification or doing things like this, I can say I've also done this other thing that's maybe related. Maybe it's not at all tangential, or but it shows that you're at least trying to be productive and, you know, you're not just whiling away the time.
Some people say finding a job should be a full-time job. I get the idea, right? You have a task every day you need to do and have a bunch of them. Yep. 8 hours a day, though, can be overwhelming and almost demoralizing. I imagine it's finding that right fit for you that I'm doing enough, but I'm not killing myself doing this.
I think that's perfectly said. Yeah, I think you're right. You have to find a good balance for you. And, you know, a lot of the people that you know may still be employed and may still have, you know, good advice and again, former colleagues, former bosses, things like that. That's why networking can also be helpful, because you can say, hey, look, I know you were laid off before. What did you do? What did you find helpful? You know, what was not as helpful? So I think making those kind of connections with people can not only make you feel better about yourself, but also, you know, give you some helpful guidance.
Tim Parody, it's always great to have you on. You cover the workplace and jobs really well. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Hope so. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, he does that for Business Insider. Brian Gordon joins us right now. He and his family have been helping people out with long-term care insurance for 50 years. 50 years on the dot, right, Brian?
You are correct. This is their 50th year.
It's great to talk to you again, my friend. The last time you were here, I was in the upstages of a flu. I think I was had so much DayQuil in my system, I hardly remember the conversation. Thanks for doing the redo today.
Not a problem. Glad you're doing better this time.
Yeah, certainly, sure. All right, Brian, I wanted to kind of go through a couple myths that I think permeate the culture about long-term care insurance, and you can either kind of confirm them, dispel them, or find middle ground. Does that sound good?
Sounds good to me.
I think a lot of people have been burned in the past by long-term care insurance, or have heard horror stories of nothing was covered. And let's be frank, a lot of us have had to deal with that with other types of insurance. And that leads people to say, well, what's the point? They're going to deny me anyways in decades when I need this thing. Is there some truth to that, or are we having a lot better plans available now?
I think that a lot of people with the older generations of policies, there's a lot of misconceptions of, you know, the policies themselves, whether it's the premium stability or how the plans actually worked. But, you know, we have seen people that have really good success with it. We have also seen a lot of people that have opened up claims the wrong way. And when we talk to them, we're like, oh, yeah, that's why you failed, because you asked for someone to drive your parents everywhere. You didn't tell them they needed help, you know, getting to the bathroom and in the shower and, you know, feeding and things like that. So people don't know what they have a lot of times. And the most important thing they can do, and unfortunately in the world we live in, a lot of sometimes the bad news travels faster than the good news. But if you open it up properly and you talk to your agent, or you talk to someone knowledgeable, they'll be able to give you direction if you have a good claim or not. I can give you, we don't have enough time today, but I can give you, you know, dozen stories of people that have opened up poorly, and then we come back and give them good direction, and they've been successful in getting that claim taken care of. So And sometimes people aren't ready to file the claim yet, and they're trying to just have them run their parents to get their hair done and their nails done, and you know, more of a convenience factor as opposed to helping with their activities of daily living or cognitive impairment.
So there's good plans out there, but you've got to use them correctly.
Correct. You got to know what you have, and we have most of our clients will, before they go on to claim, they will reach out to us, and we will go through the plan with them so the families have the right expectations. And sometimes they'll call us, and they're not ready to file the claim yet. They're like, no, they don't need help with that. Oh, no, they don't need help with that either. And, you know, then they'll call back in 4 to 6 months. They're like, oh, yeah, they need help with all that now. So that's the issues.
I have a couple more minutes to get through, but then I want to completely understand exactly what it is that you guys do at Gordon Associates. Because you kind of, like, go through all the plans. You have an idea of all of them. You whittle down a couple options for people. You help them find the plan that they want. I don't think you're not getting anything out of those sorts of things. And then, like, is that a free service that you offer? How does that work, Brian?
So what we do is we actually will sell the insurance policies. We do the reviews with our clients to figure out which plans are the best ones for their situation. And in some cases, sometimes people that these plans are not appropriate for their situation, or they can't, you know, or they just, you know, financially they can't afford it. But we always want to talk to people and show them all their different options when it comes to it. And we don't play favorites with carriers either. We're not tied down to one company. We don't have minimums to meet with carriers. We want to give people all their choices. And then, like I did with about 3 calls today, we usually whittle down 1 or 2 choices after each conversation that we have with each other.
So you kind of take a look at the broad landscape and you make sensible decisions or ideas for people. If they don't like any of them, maybe I'm sure you'd go find some more. Or if they were confused about things, you get more information. But then you mentioned like subsequent calls about filing claims. You're not like the agent, mm-hmm. though, they talk to, but are you just someone, you guys are just nice. If someone worked with you in the past, you'll help them get to the right person and figure it out?
I believe all insurance people in the insurance business should be servicing their clients when they have a claim. My property and casualty agent does a great job when we have to file a claim, or even my clients have to file claims with them. And I believe we should provide the same service for our clients. So when our clients go on to claim, they will reach out to us and we will help them. We will direct them on what to do with each carrier. And over the years, we've developed a consulting side of our business where we've had to start charging people to take their policies over as agent of record. And we will help people file their claims or become helping them service the policies down the road. We used to do that without charging people, and it got to the point where it just became a much larger part of our business.
Yeah.
And we actually have people in our office to do it. So we can help if people have situations and problems, but what we're going to do is we're going to talk to them first to make sure that they have a legitimate claim and something to argue about. Because I try to take on people only that we're going to be successful with.
Right, especially if you're going to charge someone to help them on out, which is still going to save them so much money and time and effort. I think most people will go, yes, of course, sir, I will pay you what you want, but it's good to know that you're going to look at it on the front end and go, this is not one you're going to win. Let's not even fight this battle. Is it a myth or a truth that at the age of 60, it's too late to get long-term care insurance?
That is a myth. They're healthy, if someone's healthy at 60, if they're healthy at 62, 70, 72, 75 years old, they can still qualify for policies as long as their health is good enough. We can pretty much look up to age 79 and 80 for people as well.
Wow.
But you got to make sure it makes sense at those ages.
But you're talking about people that are healthy. If you have a degenerative illness that is, you're starting to see some of the effects, it's going to be a harder battle for you to get that.
Absolutely. And that's why we always say, we talk about this before, is make sure that when you're looking at it, make sure you talk about your health up front if you have any health problems, so that the agent or the specialist you're working with can help pivot and recommend the best coverage for you or your family members.
Is 40 too young to buy one? Is there any two age where it just doesn't make sense to buy it when you're that young, or does it make total sense to buy it when you're that young?
If you're that young and you have the disposable income and you can afford it, and a lot of the people that are at the younger, under 40 have experienced it within their own families in some cases, or they're just really uber, you know, good planners for themselves, you can do that. I mean, I did my policy at 37. My wife was 35. But it depends financially where they're at. In the worksite marketplace right now, I was working on my worksite team with some businesses that we're working on quotes with, And the average age in the worksite space is like the low 40s right now for this particular organization that we work with on that.
Yeah, that was a personal question for me myself. We'll talk after the the program. And then the other one that I was, it just escaped my head. What was it? Let's try and find it. All right, so in the 40s, the age. Oh, can I use my HSA to pay long-term care insurance deductibles or any sort of lump sum payment?
So you can do, you know, HSAs, people can use a certain amount of an HSA. It's an age-based amount for that.
Okay.
And the younger we are, the smaller that amount is going to be. So it is fairly negligible in some situations. But I have some clients that have bought policies where they're guaranteed premiums for the rest of their lives. And they've got a, you know, they've got a very manageable premium. And their HSA pays their premium every single year for them.
Wow.
So they prepaid the life insurance side of it, but they're paying their balance of their long-term care and their inflation side of it through a hybrid plan, and their HSA is picking up that premium.
Every time I talk to you, you talk to John Williams, you give us great answers, and then I got a million more questions, and so do the texters. So you'll have to come back, or people can call 800-533-6242, 800-533-6242, bestltcplan.com. Brian, thanks for hopping on last minute. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, John. Appreciate that, too.
We'll do it again soon. Let's